I'm Marty Moscowen. Welcome to Radio Times. Last century, 6 million African Americans left the South and relocated in cities in the North in what is called the Great Migration. They were looking for opportunity and safety denied them in the Jim Crow South with its harsh segregation laws and its racist violence. Our guest, Charles Blow, who grew up in Louisiana, went north, put down roots in Brooklyn, and found work at the New York Times, where he is a columnist. He writes in his new book, The Devil You Know, A Black Power Manifesto, that there is no escaping racism in the United States, and that blacks fleeing the South traded the devil they knew for the devil they didn't. He has a proposal for black Americans looking for equality and justice in the North. Go back to the South and become part of a rising political force. He lives in Atlanta now, and Georgia is a living example of what black power can do. Charles Blow joins us by Skype to talk more about his big idea. Charles Blow, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Nice to be here. Thanks for having me.
Tell us a little bit about Gibbsland, Louisiana. That's where you were born. You were born in 1970, a part of the Deep South, as we call it up here in the North.
Yes, I actually born in Shreveport. That's where, you know, you had the nearest hospital, because Gibbsland is a town of about 900 people. There's no hospital in Gibbsland. But it was a majority black city, still is, still hovers around 900 people. I went to a high school that was originally found. It's one of the oldest school sites in the state of Louisiana. It was founded in the late 1800s to help to educate the sons and daughters of former slaves, and it still sits on the same patch of earth. Go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, and you also describe, and this is getting us into this conversation about the Great Migration, that you lived in a world that was shaped by vacancy. And I'm curious about how the Great Migration affected where you grew up.
Right. So my little town, small as it is, also experienced population loss because of the Great Migration. And so by the time I come along, I'm born in 1970, that is what people peg as the end of the Great Migration. But by then, you are surrounded by a disturbing number of empty homes. These are places that people just left, and there was no one to maintain them. So you'd go by one house, walk down the street, one house is filled, one house is falling down because it's empty. There seemed to me to be more work than people could do. There were more job vacancies than people could fill. So unemployment was not a thing that registered with me as a child, because everyone worked. Parents were working.
Is that vacancy, is that one of the reasons, frankly, you went north looking for opportunity?
No, there is a combination of reasons for me. One is, you know, the young boy with the wanderlust, wanting to get as far away from where he grew up as he could. And so first was Detroit, which is, you know, literally I looked out of my window at Canada, and then to New York. The other was professional opportunity. The biggest cities in America had the biggest newspapers, still do. I was a newspaper person. And so places like Detroit, New York, could have been Chicago or Los Angeles, I assume. But the big cities had the big newspapers, and so I was trying to further my career in that way.
Well, you were a columnist for the New York Times. I mean, that is a job available to so few people. It's a very powerful job, I should say. Could we also argue that you're a really good example of how the Great Migration worked by giving African Americans opportunity that they might not have gotten in the South?
I guess you could, but it's so industry specific. You know, I'm not a teacher or a factory worker. Professions that exist regardless of location, right? So, media. There's some industries. If you're a movie maker, there's very few places you could be other than Hollywood.
Right.
If you are in advertising or television news. There are very few places you could be other than New York. So there's some very, I'm kind of in an industry-specific industry, a place-specific industry. I make my argument, though, based on the larger population, which is many of the jobs that we as a population have are not so specific to region. And so for the people who have the flexibility, I want to make sure that I present them with this option.
You say, you're right. I often think of racism as having developmental cycles. And you say in the South, it's an old man. In the North, particularly in destination cities, racism is a teenage boy. Tell us what you mean by that.
It's raising and acting out. You know, when I look at things like militarization of policing, the predatory nature of policies like stop and frisk, well, these things are not happening in Birmingham or Jackson or Little Rock or Greensboro. Those are functions of these destination cities. Stop and frisk grows up in New York and is exported to Los Angeles and to Chicago. Chicago, so at one point, starts to use stop and frisk more than New York does itself. If I look at the militarization of policing, well, the SWAT team is developed in California in large part in response to the Black Panthers. That concept of kind of feeling hunted by the police, that's how people in the South used to feel about those police departments.
On a personal level, I mean, you live in Atlanta now, but you lived in New York for many, many years. How do you describe then the experience of racism, if we can speak in broad generalities, but racism in the North versus racism in the South? And this is kind of gets to the title, The Devil You Know and The Devil You Don't.
I mean, I assume that embedded in that question is a question about feelings. You know, how does it feel? I don't dwell a lot on the feelings. I'm at a point in my life where what feels doesn't matter as much to me. You know, Stokely Carmichael once said, "If someone wants to lynch me, well, that's his problem. If he has the power to lynch me, now that's my problem." So I deal with power rather than how I feel about something. And so what I see is power being armed against Black people in really incredible ways in these cities like a New York and like a LA and like a Chicago, cities that are on all other measures more liberal than other cities, right? But which gets you to the point where you start to understand that liberalism and racial egalitarianism are not completely overlapping circles.
I thank you. No, go ahead. Go ahead.
I can believe fully in fighting climate change and a woman's right to choose, in the right for gay people to get married, and believe in the identity and affirmation of trans people, and still believe that there is a problem with blackness and that whiteness is superior to it. That's a real phenomenon that I experience in those cities, both living in Detroit and then in New York. When Quinnipiac asked the citizens of New York at the height of stop and frisk, which is a predatory policing policy that disproportionately attacked Black and brown men, hunted them. When they asked the citizen of New York if they understanding that there was a problem with this and what the detriments were to it, that they still support it, a majority of white people in New York City every time said that they agree with it.
You
That's a
even,
problem.
and just to underscore that or just to follow up on that, you include in your book some work done by a group called Project Implicit, looking at regional anti-black bias. What did they find? And I think that sort of underscores what we've just been talking about. What did they find?
Sure. What they found was, they said, it's surprising to even them. which was that there was no difference between the percentage of people expressing pro-white, anti-black bias among white people, from those white people in the South and those white people in the North and those in the Midwest. None.
Looking at segregation as a kind of example of racial bias, when you look at segregation in the North, you look at segregation in the South, what do you see?
Many of these destination cities are some of the most segregated cities in America. And because the population is segregated, that also leads to the fact to they having very there being a very high percentage of segregation in their schooling. The most segregated school system in America right now is New York State's, largely because of the hyper-segregation of New York City's schools. That is not a – the southern cities don't rank.
One more follow-up to that. You also look at police shootings. And what you say, or what you write, is that when you look at police shootings, many of them took place in the North. You've got Eric Garner in New York City. You've got George Floyd in Minneapolis. Of course, he wasn't shot, but he died, was killed. You've got Tamir Rice in Cleveland. You've got Michael Brown in Ferguson. Again, helping us understand this view that you have of racism in the North. Help us dig deeper on that.
Right. What police shootings were very evenly spread across the country. So that was not a Southern phenomenon. And in fact, many of the most high profile police shooting, where the shootings or killings, where the killing was the most egregious, was not actually in the South, in the North, but in the South, but in the North and the Midwest and the West. To expand on that, which is the concept of mass incarceration, that too is largely a northern western state phenomenon when it comes to black people specifically. A lot of people look at southern states and say the incarceration rates are incredibly high in these states. That's true, but they're also incarcerating a lot of white people. What you have to do is look at states and say, of the number of black people you have, how many are you incarcerating? And when you look at the incarceration rates per capita for black people, the southern states don't really register in that in the top. Hmm. The number one place for black men being incarcerated is Vermont, one of the most liberal states in the union. It gives you Bernie Sanders. It is where Barack Obama gets his highest percentage of the white vote in 2008.
Charles Boyle, we need to take a very short break. I want to pick up on several things that you said, and I want to make sure our listeners can join us on Radio Times. Charles Boyle is our guest. He's got a new book, The Devil You Know, A Black Power Manifesto. You can join us. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can call us. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Marty Moscoen, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. Our guest is Charles Boyle. He's a columnist for the New York Times. He also has a new book called The Devil You Know, A Black Power Manifesto, offering a plan to empower Black Americans to fight white supremacy by reversing the course of the Great Migration when 6 million African Americans left the South for the North. This happened in the 20th century. He's saying, come back South, which is where he lives now. And again, you can join us, questions or comments, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can call us 1-888-477-9499. Part of my, and I think for a lot of white people living in the North, they look at the South, they see the Confederate battle flag, they see Confederate statues. We all know about Charlottesville, that is a picture of the South that I think a lot of people in the North have. What's a better picture? What's a more accurate picture?
Well, one of them is that there are 1,200 majority black cities in America. 90% of them are in the South. Right now, a fourth of all black people in America live under black municipal control. Maynard Jackson became the first black mayor of a major southern city in 1973, large part because Atlanta, for the first time, became a majority black city in 1970. But since him, today, almost every major southern city has a black mayor. Many of them are very young. They are dynamic. They are trying to change this region. It is the reason that in the last election cycle, we got Stacey Abrams from Georgia and Andrew Gillum from Florida. It is the reason that Stacey has now helped to transform Georgia and the voting electorate. It is because these young, dynamic people exist here. It is a transformative experience to land in Jackson, Mississippi, which is which has overtaken Detroit as the blackest large city in America. Land there and have this young black mayor come on the intercom and welcome you to the Medgar Evers International Airport, because you understand that you're now in a place where your identity and your culture has a primacy and is not additive. In addition to that, the black middle class is thriving in many of these southern black cities. When you look at the where black-owned businesses are thriving, the Southeast is the number one region for those black-owned businesses. The list goes on and on from where medium household income has gone up and how incomes have increased over time, including for people without a college degree, black people. All of those things paint a very different picture of the South. Are there Confederate flags in some places? Of course there are. Sure. Are there monuments in some places? Of course there are. But can I go to a place like a New Orleans where everything about the city is infused with my identity? The food is black. The music is created largely by black people. The entire culture of the city lives and breathes and reflects you.
Let me ask you about this. I mean, you call it a big idea, so I'll use that as well, your big idea. And you were actually inspired by a speech that Harry Belafonte gave a number of years ago, asking really a very profound question: where are the radical thinkers? And as you write in this book, you say that question really hung on you. I mean, it really affected you. And this is your radical idea. Go south.
Yes, exactly. You know, because what the question said to me was it made me analyze whether or not I was using my voice and my position in the best, most profound ways that I could. Was I just writing about the political machinations of the day or the week? Or was I trying to dig deeper? Was I trying to say something bigger? Was I trying to put things into a larger context? And that became a driving motivational factor for me, not just being on the hamster wheel, but stepping back. What are you really saying? What are you really contributing to the conversation?
One of the things you write, and I do want to talk about this reverse migration as you describe it, but again, this is looking at who you describe as the kind of northern liberals, the people who believe in climate change and gay marriage and all the things that you describe. But you also talked about this illusion of moral superiority. Help us understand that. And is part of that looking down on white people in the South?
That is exactly what was happening for a very long time. You know, people would get disgusted. Part of the cleaving point, I think, was cruelty. It wasn't that people in the North thought blacks were completely equal to white people any more than people in the South. They disliked the cruelty. And so when during the civil rights movement and they put the dogs on people and beat people in the street, it's not that people thought civil rights should advance at the pace that it did. In fact, the New York Times at the time did polling around this, and people in New York didn't think it should advance that fast, but they didn't like the cruelty. That cruelty was an embarrassment to the race. People wanted to punish Bull Connor. They didn't necessarily want to elevate Black people.
You're saying that, again, we're speaking in these broad terms, but nonetheless, mm-hmm. that it made white people look bad to have Bull Connor
yes.
beating Black
Absolutely.
People?
Absolutely. It was the cruelty that people responded to. You can't behave this way. And yet when Martin Luther King went north to Chicago to fight for fair housing, all of a sudden he was taking it out of the South. And now he was talking about integrating your white neighborhood in the North, in Chicago. And as he put it, he had never seen anything as violent as the responses that he got in Chicago after mm-hmm. all of his marching in the South. As Andrew Young put it, they would show up in the South and maybe 200 white supremacists, maybe Klans people would show up in opposition. In Chicago, thousands of people showed up and threw everything they could pick up at Martin Luther King.
How though, and you mentioned Bull Connor, so how in the space of what, 50, 60 years, which is both a long time and a short time, but how mm-hmm. did the South then go from Bull Connor to this place where you've got, you know, a thousand Black-run cities?
Mm-hmm. King explains this in an essay he wrote in the Saturday Review, I think Red Review, not Post, I think it's Review, shortly after the riots in Watts. And he explains how the civil rights movement was largely a regional movement, and the benefits of it largely redounded to the South. And in fact, over the same time that they had been executing the civil rights movement, conditions in northern and western cities actually deteriorated rather than got better. So you saw in those southern cities the real fruit of the civil rights movement, where Black people felt comfortable in those cities. To a large degree, it was in the bigger cities with the bigger police departments where you felt the least safe in the South before, because they were using the police against you. The same thing that I see now happening in northern and western cities.
Let me reintroduce you. That's Charles Blow. He's a New York Times columnist. He's got a new book, which is what we're talking about. It's titled The Devil You Know, A Black Power Manifesto. And it's based on an idea he has of reversing the Great Migration. In the 20th century, something like 6 million African Americans left the South looking for opportunity, for better education, for safety for themselves and their children. And he's saying, let's take another look at the South. It's a very different kind of place. Come on back and let's create a very strong Black political environment. You can join us. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And you can call us at 1-888-477-9499. Charles Blow, let me quote something you said, which is, mm-hmm. I am unapologetically pro-Black, not because I believe in Black supremacy, which is as false and reckless a notion as white supremacy, but rather because I insist upon Black equity and equality. In a society and system in which white supremacy is ubiquitous and inveterate, Black people need fierce advocates to help them to restore the balance, or more precisely, establish the balance in the first place. Speak to that. Flesh that out for us.
Yeah, I mean, I don't believe in racial hierarchies, because I don't believe that race, as we have come to define it, is a real thing. It's just that racism is a very real thing. And in that context, Black people have lived in a society that has largely been governed by a sense of white supremacy from the very beginning. And that white supremacy is by no means gone, and it is by no means gone from the halls of power in this country. And so in order for Black people to draw to equity of both opportunity and inclusion, is going to require fierce advocates to help that along. And I fully intend to be one of those advocates.
I mean, you're a newspaper man, as you describe it, and sort of haven't been an advocate. Is this something new for you?
Well, I mean, I think we're using advocate in different ways. There's a way that the journalist advocates, which is through the writing. I am not a community organizer. There are people who do that. I am not a person who organizes protests. There are people who do that. I don't even attend protests unless I'm covering the protests. So that I want to separate that sort of advocacy from the people who do that other work, which is very important. What I do is I bear witness, and that is my way of advocating for things.
Here's a couple of comments. One from Dan, who says, there is certainly racism and racial inequality in our society, but I believe some of the problems stem from more socioeconomic issues than race, like the higher incarceration rates among Black Americans. You were talking earlier about incarceration rates. Can you speak to Dan's comment there?
Sure. How do you separate the oppression of Black people and white supremacy from those incarceration rates? Right. What all the data show, Black people are more likely to be stopped for things than white people. Black people are more likely to be sentenced for things, even when they're charged with the same charge. Their sentences are more likely to be longer than white people for the same crimes. We now know there's a disproportionate number of people who are incarcerated for low-level drug crimes, just possession. Black kids and white kids use marijuana at exactly the same rate. And yet 80 to 90% of drug arrests for possession are Black kids. Why is that? How can you separate that from the fact that that the police are preying on these kids? They are searching them out to stop, interrogate, and frisk. And that is how they find it. If they searched out, interrogated, and frisked the exact same number of white kids, you would have the exact same number of white kids arrested for possession because they're all using marijuana at the same rate.
Here's another comment. This one from Avi. He says, from my point of view, the clearest manifestation of discrimination in our area, that would be the Philadelphia area, is the huge difference in the quality of high schools in Philadelphia compared to the suburbs. Is the reverse migration going to lead to quality schools, and how would that be done?
Well, part of why we have inequality in schooling is the way that we finance schooling, which is locally. And so if you have housing segregation, you by default have education in terms of how much schools get and spend. The states, however, state and local, majority of schools get half or more of their funding from state and local governments. State and local governments can go a long way towards evening this out if that is their intention. A reverse migration in which people understand that this is a problem, a racial problem, and are intent on removing racial problems can go a long way in addressing this.
Let me get a caller to join us. So this is Reverend Sean James. And Reverend James, you were calling at Radio Times. Go ahead, you're on the air.
Yes, thank you, Marty, and welcome to your guest. I was wondering if my reverse migration for African Americans is something that has not already happened. My family kind of being an example of that. My parents met at Morehouse and Spelman in the 70s. Our family was raised in Chicago in the 80s, and then our family moved back to Atlanta in the late 80s. And I saw Atlanta really take off during that time, mostly from people moving from the North back to the South. My dad said that Black people were at their best in the South. He really enjoyed leaving the hustle and bustle of the North, moving back down South, where he eventually ended up working at his alma mater. So I completely agree with everything the caller is saying about the positives of it, especially in schooling. I grew up in public schools in Atlanta. that were absolutely fantastic. But I'm wondering if this is something that hasn't already happened, and what the author is asking for is an increase of a phenomenon that kind of happened nascently.
I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Charles Blow, go ahead.
Yes, I think the caller makes an excellent point. The reverse migration has been happening for at least two or three decades. Newspapers and magazines have been writing about it seriously for over a decade. I think in 2018, 82,000 millennials alone moved back to the South from northern and western cities. So this is a phenomenon already in the way. What I am trying to do is, you know, to give it a boost, an adrenaline boost. By my calculations, already in the last two or three decades, more Black people have returned to the South than went north and west during the first wave of the Great Migration. But that migration started in 1916. There are now four times as many Black people in America as there were in 1916. So it doesn't, as a percentage-wise, it is not as big of a reverse. What I'm trying to do is to say, boost it. And what and the reason I'm doing that is because that is what Northern newspaper people, the Black press, did for the Great Migration. They added an incentive. They added a moral clarity to it. They helped to boost the migration. I am trying to exist in the legacy of those Black members of the Black press and give a boost to the reverse migration.
Well, let's take another break and then we'll get back to our conversation. That's Charles Blow. He's a columnist for The New York Times. He's written several books, the new one just out called The Devil You Know, A Black Power Manifesto. And we want to hear from you. Questions or comments, Radio Time or stories, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And you can call us 1-888-477-9499. Much more after this short break. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen, talking with Charles Blow, and let me just recap what we are talking about. The power of Black voters was evident after President Biden won the 2020 presidential race and the Democratic Senate victories in Georgia. And in his new book, Charles Blow argues, and I should say the book is called The Devil You Know, A Black Power Manifesto. He looks at racism in the country, the failure of white liberals to dismantle white supremacy, and argues that in order to become a powerful political force and make lasting change, Black Americans should reverse the course of the Great Migration and return to the South. And again, Charles Blow, join us by Skype. He lives in Atlanta now. And we want to hear from you. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can call us at 1-888-477-9499. Charles Blow, I don't want to skip over what happened to your son. He was a student at Yale University when he was held at gunpoint by a white police officer. Black police officer. But you write a lot about this, and certainly as father of an African-American son, you know, this is an all too familiar story. But take us into this story and help us understand just what that meant for you and for your son.
Right. So it is an extension of the kind of fear I felt for them in the Northeast. Right. So I have two boys, one girl. My boys come of age during stop and frisk at a time when Michael Bloomberg was saying that his lowest age of target was 16 years old. And they are stopping at the height of stop and frisk. They are stopping and frisking more young Black men in New York City, boys and men. I keep saying boys because some of these are children, than there were young Black boys and men in Chicago, which meant that if my boys were not taking a stop and frisk, somebody on the other side of town was taking it for them. So I lived in this hyper-vigilant, hyper-anxious sense for my own children, just being out, taking a bus or going on the subway, worrying that they would run into a police officer, and hopefully that would go, that interaction would go smoothly, but it had covered so many killings of unarmed Black people. I understood that most of those happened, those interactions began for minor infractions.
Do you think it's changed now? I mean, Philadelphia certainly stop and frisk as well.
I don't see how it's changed. And also, you have to look at where that urgency around the commodification of penalty is happening. A lot of it is in these what supposedly liberal cities in the North and West. If you look at right now, the cities that are under consent decree with the federal, with the Department of Justice, because they had a pattern and practice of violating people's civil rights, only two of those cities are in the South. All the rest of them are cities in the North and West, many places to which people, Black people, migrated.
Here's a comment from David. I actually had this question as well. I'll have David ask it. He says, are we giving up on integration as a goal?
Well, I think you can't really ask me that question, because what does integration mean to you? For the last 90 years, every state in America has, except Hawaii, has been majority white. And that is not a natural result of natural migration. They were white terror, chased Black people out of the South where they would have been majorities in some of those states. White terror vanquished Native Americans from spaces that would have become states and would have been majority Native American. White terror got rid of a large percentage of Hispanic people in the West where that was basically their territory. This idea that white people are the majority in every state, that is not natural. That is not natural migration patterns. That is the result of a terror campaign, multiple terror campaigns. Right now, there are seven states in America that are 90%+ white, and no one ever asked me if that is a problem for integration. No one says a word about it. There are four times as many Black people in America as in those seven states. Those seven states represent about 3% of the American population, but they control 14 of America's 100 Senate seats, and no one says a word.
Let me quote the Pew Research Center, which actually you quoted in a recent piece that you had in the New York Times. About a quarter of voting members, 23% of the U.S. House of Representatives and Senate, are racial or ethnic majorities, making the 117th Congress the most racially and ethnically diverse in history. 13% of House members are Black, about equal to the share of Black Americans. Is that a sign that our system is working and that it is more inclusive?
Yeah, but inclusiveness does not mean the elimination of anti-Blackness, right? If I look around, because a part of what the misconception people have is that everyone who is not white is on the same page and looking at and have a common sense of values, a common sense of priorities, and that they, within that group of brownness, are not also anti-Black. That's false. Number one, a third of both, in 2016, a third of both Hispanics and Asians voted for Donald Trump, whatever their reasons may be. But he had already waged this racist campaign against Barack Obama. He had already called Mexicans rapists. He had already said that Islam hates us and proposed a Muslim travel ban. He had already done those things when a third of Hispanics and a third of Asians voted for him. And this time around, the appreciable increase, real surges, were in those minority immigrant communities for Donald Trump. If you look around at any society in America, in the world, modern society, where there is difference in appearance, some people darker, some people lighter, it is hard to find a place on the planet where darker skinned people are not assigned the lower caste.
So when we say people of color, should we get rid of that? Because you're saying it includes people that don't necessarily see each other as allies and have very different experiences.
There, even within those groups, there are people who see people have very different experiences. People who Hispanics who come from islands or countries that front on the Atlantic coast have very little in common with people, Hispanics who come from countries or islands that front on the Pacific coast. And yet we lump them all together.
You mentioned President Trump. Is he based on, I mean, there's a long list, being a birther, the things he said before becoming president, the things that he said when he was president about S-hole countries and the Muslim ban and Mexicans, Confederate flags, is a long list here. Is he the devil we know in that his racism was so overt?
Well, I mean, he's a racist. I mean, that's not a question anymore. But here's the thing. Other than some extreme policies like, you know, child separation, many of his policies are not far afield from mainstream Republican policies. The anti-immigrant fervor, the voter suppression inclination. He was not the only Republican who questioned whether Barack Obama was in this country legally or was an American citizen and could run. Part of us wants to say Trump broke all the norms. What we should be saying is, or acknowledging, is how many of the norms he simply upheld.
Did he break the norms because he said it rather than think it?
And do it. People were already, from the moment that the Supreme Court basically gutted the Voting Rights Act, for one provision of it, people could not pass legislation fast enough, Republicans, to try to disenfranchise people from voting, and a lot of those people were Black people. They couldn't do it fast enough. Trump comes in and says a lot of horrible things. But people were doing horrible things already.
Let me pick up on that. Here's an email from Desmonde who says, I understand and for the most part agree with your speaker, but how optimistic can we be and how much stock can we put in the value of reverse migration when we are witnessing backlash in states such as Georgia, Florida, North Carolina, among others, to negate Black political power by purging voter rolls, legislating barriers to registration, attempting to hamper mail-in ballots, etc. Charles Blow, what do you say to Desmonde?
Well, I say that strong organizing goes a long way towards mitigating that, which is what Stacey Abrams and all the groups here in Georgia showed us. But also, I put to people who make that case, how much political power do you actually have? If you're 11% of the population in the entire state of Pennsylvania, your vote only works when white people basically split down the middle. You're the extra. You can't do it yourself. You can give one side or the other the boost. You can't elect a senator of your own. You can't deliver a state on your own. How much power do you have? Or are you under the delusion that you're powerful because you break the tie when white people split?
This is part of your argument, which is that in certain ways, it's state power is kind of where the power is, or even regional power is where the actual power is. We spend so much time talking about, you know, Congress and the White House. But what you're saying is that where the action is really at the state level.
Well, half of it. I mean, the Constitution makes it very clear. There's a reason that the United States of America is called the United States of America. It's the Federation of States. And half of the power is in the states. In fact, the Constitution says all powers not specifically given to the federal government are reserved for the states. And so elections are conducted by the state. That's why we have all these variations in how people vote and how, who has access to the ballot. And it's all over the place because every state can set their own requirements. Yes, go ahead.
No. I'm looking at the clock, and I don't mean to step on your toes there, but sure. I mean, in a way, you're making a states' rights argument, correct?
Absolutely. I'm saying to Black people, all of the mechanisms of power that were used to oppress you can be used for your liberation. The Electoral College and the Senate are compromises to slave states. When they didn't want to count you as a full citizen, but they wanted to count you as property and give those slave owners something for having you there. The entire states' right argument was used by segregationists and white supremacists to say they should be able to handle the racial issue on their own in their own time. Use that argument against the people who used it against you.
Let me raise a couple of more things. I mean, obviously, we've got a new president in the White House, Joe Biden. And you say several things. One, talking about President Obama, that liberals protected Obama instead of tasking him, and that I guess liberals, progressives, must hold Biden's feet to the fire to call for true transformational change. Do you think Biden can do what perhaps Obama could not?
It's not clear to me. And I want to say this about Obama. He was taking so much unfair fire that people had to make a calculation. Do I criticize this guy the same way I would criticize other people and basically add to this avalanche of unfair, sometimes racist attack that he's under? Or do I just hold it for now and just say he's competent and he's trying? And I'm just going to cut him some slack because what he's experiencing is almost without precedent. And I think a lot of people said to themselves, I'm just going to cut him some slack because I don't want to add to this horrible thing that's happening to him and his family. But the problem is that when you do that, the only pressure that that person feels is from the opposition. And they start to try to placate the opposition to calm them down rather than full-throatedly trying to get your agenda through. What we see with Biden is there more people are recognizing, okay, we didn't do this with Obama. We kind of have to do it with Biden because otherwise we won't get the full raft of policies that we want to have passed by a Democratic president.
About a minute before we have to end our conversation. This is a little more personal question, but you say there's something about the South that, as a Black person, speaks to me spiritually. Now that you live in Atlanta, you grew up in Louisiana. What is that thing that speaks to you spiritually?
Well, there is a deeper connection to heritage, legacy, and land in the South. For the 400 years since Black people have been in America, the majority of them have always lived in the South. If you go to a cemetery, if you live in a Black person and you live in New York, you go to the cemetery. Maybe your grandfather's there. Maybe if he was part of the first wave of the Great Migration. But your institutions, your legacy, your cultural import is most heavily rooted in the South.
So you feel it when you're there, living
Absolutely.
There now.
Absolutely.
Charles Blow, thank you very much. Thanks for joining us today in Radio Times.
Thank you so much for having me.
You're very welcome. And again, he is a columnist for the New York Times, wrote a memoir called Fire Shut Up in My Bones. And he's got a new book. It's called The Devil You Know, A Black Power Manifesto. Go to whyy.org/Radio Times to find out more about the program. You can always download a podcast of the show wherever you get your podcasts, and we've got lots and lots of them there for you to listen to. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Kelsey Hansen. I'm Marty Moscoe. Thank you so much for joining us.